Prepare for a Gopher football knowledge bomb. This is the FBT podcast with hosts MV.
That's pretty damn good. I like it. That's pretty good.
You want me to go to Las Vegas at once?
As your attorney, I advise you to rent a very fast car with no top. Tape recorder for special music. Get the hell out of LA for at least 48 hours.
We can't stop here. This is bat country.
Right, folks, it is game week. Time to get your UNLV preparation caps on because it's the FBT podcast, and we've got the entire brain trust here. Karate Gopher, Karate.
What up?
And Elliot is also joining us.
What's going on, guys?
All right, as always, I am MV. This is the FBT podcast, and we are talking all things UNLV running Rebels in the beginning of the season here. So
yeah!
Are you guys thinking here that this is the perfect opportunity for us to descend upon Las Vegas as either Hunter S. Thompson in Fear and Loathing, and then possibly, once we are there, stay like Ben Sanderson and leaving Las Vegas?
I tell you what, if we lose, I'm going to be Ben Sanderson Redux, and there's no question about it. I will not pass go. I will not stop at the craps table and throw dice. I will not lose all my money gambling. I will go and pick up three or four handles of bourbon. I will go back in my room. I will drink in the shower. A decent chance I will drown in the shower. And so this may very well be my last Gopher podcast. But let's not kill the positive vibe, you know, 2 minutes into this podcast. I think we've got a decent chance this week. I'm liking it. I think UNLV, as we'll talk about a little bit, has well, let's just say that they're weak in a few areas, but yeah. I think that it's going to be epic. I'm going to get to go. It'll be my first time in Vegas in about 7 years, and it's going to be epic regardless of the outcome.
Yeah, I think this is what better way. I mean, if you're going to play a road game, you know, to start the season, what better place to go for your fan base than to send them off to Las Vegas? I mean, it's like a built-in debaucherous weekend all in one. You can gamble, you can drink, you can party, go to the Crazy Horse. Oh, actually, that Crazy Horse doesn't exist anymore. But yeah, it's perfect. Perfect location to start the season if you can't start it at home.
Yeah, I will be changing my Twitter handle, I think, to Dr. Gonzo this weekend. We'll be tweeting nothing but my experiences with LSD, ether, mezcaline, maybe some ketamine. You know, we're going to go all out. And
the bats, Frothy, the bats.
Yep.
Yes, it is bat country.
Exactly.
Bat country. So we are, I mean, I do expect to get a Voxer call from Frothy where he's saying that he's trying to park on the sidewalk, you know, and saying things like, you know, is this not acceptable place to park?
Why not? Is this not a reasonable place to park?
That's at the end of the season last year, I kind of just floated the idea to my wife, like, hey, the Gophers are going to open the season in Vegas. And she was like, oh, yeah, we could go to that. And I kind of froze and I was like, okay, well, you know, thinking we should get tickets. Luckily, we didn't because now we're about 4 weeks away from her being full term. She's pregnant. So it wouldn't have worked out as it were, unless I guess that would bring a whole nother level to the debauchery is bringing a almost full term pregnancy woman into it.
Or you could do the absolutely perfect sort of Frothy Gopher-esque sort of move and say, sorry, baby, I know you're knocked up, but I'm going to go to
My dad is actually going, though. I was actually he called late and was like, oh, yeah, I guess I got pulled into Vegas. And I was like, well, there's worse things you get pulled into, though. But yeah, great opening game. And, you know, you're not playing East Dakota or something like that. So really can't complain about that.
Yeah, I mean let's move right into talking about UNLV and what we can sort of expect from this team. Now, I'm not going to sugarcoat it here, but UNLV in their first 2 years under Bobby Hauk, formerly of Montana, FCS Power fame. They have not been a very good football team over the last 2 years.
Oh, they're effing terrible.
Yeah.
They should not lose. The Gophers should really not lose this game. It'll be, I mean, well, I shouldn't even say that because every time we sit there, I remember some idiot writing a probably 1,000-word column about how they were going to beat New Mexico State very easily and that was going to set them on the right track. So I shouldn't make any sort of predictions. But if the Gophers lose this game, they really have, it's going to be a long year.
Yeah, I agree with this completely. UNLV, I mean, no matter how bad things have appeared during the last two seasons of Gopher football, they really pale in comparison to the pit that UNLV has found themselves in over the last, 12 years or so? It's been 12 years since they went to a bowl. Last season, they not only just got whitewashed in basically every category and in every game, but they actually were down 41-10 to an FCS team in the fourth quarter, Southern Utah. And when I watched the film of the Southern Utah UNLV game, Southern Utah looked like they were high school players, compared like size-wise, and yet they still just, you could see the level of quit in the Rebels as they were just getting absolutely murdered in the fourth quarter by guys that really had no business even coming within two touchdowns of them. So this is a team that I think you can, if the Gophers are going to show any signs of improvement and they are taking the leap, which we think they are, they should be able to thoroughly handle and out-athlete and out-big these guys because they simply just are. I mean, this is not a very good football team. They are fundamentally broken in a lot of different positions. They have some good individual players, but in terms of where they're at as a team, this shouldn't be a contest.
Here's the thing that got me kind of to your point, Matt, is, you know, I've spent some time, you know, in the literal just minutes and minutes of research that I do through this podcast. You find an awful lot of players from their practice reports saying things like, yeah, this year is going to be different. This year's players want to play, right? And then you see, and I look at that and think, what do you mean this year's players want to play? Players on the team last year that didn't want to play? That's like Chris Rock's old joke, like where these, you know, parents will say, well, whatever, I take care of my kids. Well, you're supposed to take care of your kids, right? Yeah. You're supposed to want to play if you're a Division I full scholarship athlete. So, you know, I know that Hoke is taking on this job of trying to turn the program around, and there's an awful lot of work that's associated with that. But, you know, this is his third year. So 2 years in, you had players that weren't interested in really playing. And when they got pushed a little bit by an FCS team, they just went and quit. Now, I'm not going to sit here and crucify UNLV for losing to an FCS team because, well, we all know what happened to us last year. But at the same time, you know, they got absolutely, you know, piss pounded, you know, 41-10 by something called Southern Utah University. So, you know, it's tough. The other thing that struck me is, you know, you read some of Hauk's comments, and just about every single thing he says is includes the word hope. And, well, I hope our receivers can step up. I hope our redshirt freshman quarterback can step up. I hope our offensive line doesn't give up 36 sacks again this season. He's really kind of full of hope. And while certainly if you're coaching a team that's as big of a dumpster fire as UNLV, and again, you know, certainly the argument could be made that we're a bit of a dumpster fire as well. You know, I guess hope has to be part of the equation, but goddamn, I mean, as a head coach, I would hope, you know, in year three that he's going to be talking about things that go, you know, are more concrete than, well, I certainly hope that our receivers have a grand total of 8 catches for 85 yards last year are going to be able to step up and compete at a high level.
Well, I love when the quotes, when you get quotes like that, you were just saying before about, you know, now people want to play, or I like when it's, well, we have 11 guys on each side, where they're more just declarative statements more than actual insight or analysis. They're just, you know, we have jerseys on this year, you know, that kind of thing, where it's like, well, yeah, that kind of, I mean, it lets you know that things are not exactly doing very well. And again, for the Gophers, things haven't gone as well either. But what are you guys expecting offensively for the Rebels to come out doing? Let's talk about the defense, I guess, first. How do you expect the defense to react to the Rebels? What are you looking for good, bad, and ugly, I guess, from the Gophers. Just as we had talked before a little bit, the run defense is something that I think is an issue this year, you know, certainly was last year, will be going forward this year. What do you guys think about that kind of moving ahead, or what are you guys going to be looking at as far as from the Gophers defense?
All right. So in the couple of minutes that I looked at, I think I may have spent five more minutes looking at film than Frothy did, but we obviously watched the same film on this stuff. So UNLV runs the same type of offensive line running blocks as the Gophers do. So they do a lot of pin and pull. They run inside zone. They do a lot of power. They also do a little bit of outside zone stretch. And then you can also look back to Houck's pedigree at Montana, where Montana was in the top 20 in rushing attempts each of his last five seasons there. And basically the only other team that stood out to me that was noticeable for this podcast anyway was Southern Illinois when Kill was there. So the running game is going to look very similar to what the Gopher defense sees in practice every single day, because Gophers have three offensive line blocks, primarily pin and pull, inside zone, and power. And they run a lot of 12 personnel, you know, 22 personnel stuff, much like UNLV is going to do. So it's a situation in which they're going to run the ball. And for UNLV, they do return all five of their offensive linemen. Two of them, I would say, are really good. Their left tackle, Brett Boyko, and then their center, Wasserman. They're both sophomores. They started as redshirt freshmen last year. And they have some talent. They are fairly good. I mean, I'm saying this not trying to disparage, like give them a pat on the head, you know, like a dog or something. But they are very good. Some of their other offensive linemen, I don't think necessarily returning those players is a good thing. You would hope that somebody else would have beat them out in that position, because they frankly weren't all that good on film last year. But they do have a really good running back in Tim Cornette. Another back in Deonza Bradford, who ran for about 600 yards. So coincidentally, Cornette and Bradford ran for over 600 yards. And I think they combined for about 15 touchdowns or so. So the running game is going to be the staple. And especially when you have a redshirt freshman who's never taken a snap before, and Nick Sherry has taken over as a starting quarterback, you're going to emphasize running the ball. And for Houck, even more so, his philosophy is to run the ball. They're going to be very much a run first team this year. Now, in terms of how the Gopher defense is going to handle this, well, they're going to be familiar with it because it's very similar to what their offense runs. But I am a little bit skittish, if I could use that word, about how the interior of our defense, namely defensive tackles not named Optimus Prime and our middle linebackers, are going to hold up. I mentioned this in an earlier podcast, but Rollis isn't the type of player that really inspires confidence in me that he's going to be able to shed a block from a center or pulling guard and or take out a fullback and kind of shed that and kind of be tough in the middle. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I do hope happens is that we see Brendan Beal take a snap and then, you know, as the middle linebacker, and then just absolutely destroy a fullback or, you know, shed a block from a center and then just crush a running back into the backfield and just take him down to the ground. That will be an incredibly important step for this run defense moving forward, is if the coordination between the two defensive tackles and the middle linebacker. So we'll see. I don't know if this is going to be a harbinger of things to come. If UNLV can run the ball on us a little bit, that might scare me thinking about what Wisconsin and Nebraska are going to do. But again, this is a team, a UNLV running Rebels team, that really has no passing game, so to speak of. They return basically no wide receivers, and their quarterback is going to be, I'm guessing, going to be extremely limited by a head coach to not go ahead and just start bombing the ball when there's a huge propensity that could lead to about a 7-interception game.
I'm interested to see how Nick Sherry plays as a redshirt freshman. Granted, he's not a true freshman, but it's always interesting to see young guys. Well, even when Chartel came in, USC last year, and I remember just thinking like, oh shit, here come the wheels are going to fall off. And he, you know, played pretty well, all things considered. So I'm interested to see how Sherry handles that, and knowing little else about Nick Sherry than what I've read in the last week, because I'm not a great UNLV football mind. if we were talking about the Larry Johnson running Rebels, then we could, you know, then I can break down a little bit more. But I'm interested, as you said, with Rallis, where, you know, he was a guy, he was, you know, good player, smart guy, off the field, whatever. Has trouble shedding blocks as an outside linebacker, even bulking up. You know, that doesn't mean he just turns into Ray Lewis or Zach Thomas or whoever. So I'm interested to see him against a, you know, maybe a lower tier rushing attack that's still decent, but yet, like it's not a Michigan, Nebraska, Wisconsin type team. I'm interested to see how the interior defense kind of handles between the, you know, up the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big test. And I actually will think that this is our, if we can't stop this run consistently, they're going to run because they won't be able to pass it. Nick Sherry is going to be better than Caleb Herring, only because I think it would be impossible to not be better than Caleb Herring. I mean, bless him, he went out there and sure tried, but he doesn't look like a Division One quarterback. I think Nick Sherry, you know, he has all the numbers there, but what are you getting? I mean, he's a big kid, about 6'5", 240, and he, you know, from all accounts, he was pretty well regarded coming out of high school. He's got, you know, he looks like he's probably going to be capable of being pretty good, but you never know what you're getting until the full live game action. So, you know, he could come out and say, to hell with it. I got nothing to lose. I'm a freshman. Nobody's expecting anything of me. Have a devil may care attitude and try and throw the ball deep. You know, certainly reading some of the practice reports again, throwing the ball deep is something that UNLV wants to do. I mean, you look at their passing statistics from last year. They averaged 109 passing yards per game. 109. This isn't Glenn Mason's, you know, well, we only have 100 yards passing because we rush for 400 yards. They only rush for about 170, 190 yards a game in that range. So that was an absolutely inept passing attack last year. And they lose their top two receivers. So, you know, again, they literally may return less than 15 receptions this year and really not much more than about 100 yards in receiving from the tight ends and the wide receivers. So I think they're going to try and pass the ball. I'd be very, very surprised if they're able to pass the ball, which means they're going to run. So they're going to run. They're going to get, you know, probably, you know, 150 to 250 yards of rushing. And I'd be okay with that. But I would be concerned if they're able to move the ball as easily as, say, you know, Middle Tennessee was able to move the ball on us a couple of years back. That was a harbinger of a bad, bad defense. And so if a team of UNLV caliber, and I'm not, you know, I'll rip on UNLV, but I recognize that, you know, I think MV, you pointed out, there are an awful lot of similarities between UNLV and Minnesota. They're like our non-automatic qualifying little brother. You know, I think to the extent that they're able to move the ball effectively against us and neutralize Rallis and neutralize our defensive tackles, it's going to be scary later on this season.
Yeah, I think the thing that concerns me the most is not whether Optimus Prime is going to be able to handle this really small interior guard and center play of UNLV, because I think that it's obvious that he's going to. I think he's going to have a really big game because, quite frankly, their guard, their starting right guard from last season was, you know, really bad. He's probably one of the slowest pulling right guards that I've seen on film, and I've watched a lot of film on that. But again, it's all about, you know, who opposite Optimus is going to step up and really fill those running lanes, you know, and be able to, you know, fight through some of those some of the trash and the wash of those offensive linemen. I mean, if they can get the one thing that really scares me, and I want to make sure that this actually doesn't happen, but when UNLV runs pin and pull, so they're pulling their center and then their guard into the boundary, you know, similar to what we do for our running game, when they run pin and pull into the boundary, how fast is our corner, you know, is going to be Troy Sudemeyer, you know, our safety, and then our linebacker is going to be able to hit that spot and be able to beat them to that pin and pull spot so that they can, you know, effectively tackle them. Now, I know we have a lot more speed on defense, and so theoretically, they should not be able to burn us for these type of running plays like they'd be able to burn Hawaii. But again, how are they going to be able to handle that? Are they going to be able to effectively beat the two tight end, one single back type offense that Hauk is going to run at times and fill every single one of those gaps? It's going to be a real good test to see how much our team speed along the edges has improved and whether or not they are going to be able to translate that into future games in the Big Ten. So up the middle might be bad. Running things to the outside, we might actually be pretty good. So maybe that'll tell us something. But I'm actually thinking that this particular game is not going to tell us a lot about this team, about what we're going to know about this Gopher football team, any more than, say, losing to Michigan would, if I was going to pick a game. Moving on to the running Rebel defense here. You know, this is a defense that, not surprisingly, gave up a whole bunch of points last year and couldn't really stop anyone. So one of the things that I'm kind of interested in to see is how well the quote-unquote camp speed that and moving more laterally and toward the edges and attacking the edges of the defense more that Linebreaker was discussing toward in the last week or so can manifest itself against a team like this. UNLV is a team that doesn't have a lot of speed along their defensive line. They were a poor tackling team last year, even though they really kind of jammed the box with, you know, 8 or 9 men a lot. They give up a lot of rushing yards, and they were able to give up passing yards all over the place. So even though the word from UNLV camp and from some of the reports that I've read is that they are improved, they like their defensive front. They think that this is maybe one of their deeper defensive lines in terms of rotation in years. But I'm still curious to see how well they can actually hold up against a Big Ten offense that really did get better as the year went along. And then if we see the full maturation of Gray and not just a repeat of Proto Gray.
Proto Gray, of course, being the early version of Gray that we saw last year, particularly in the season where he hadn't yet fully matured into the adult Marquise Gray that we saw in the Illinois game. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, they're just again in the minutes of research, taking a look at UNLV's defense. You know, they actually are returning some pretty decent players on defense, and it's all relative. And you know, as Elliot pointed out, you know, that loss to New Mexico State last year is just poisoning my analysis of this game because I want to say that UNLV is a team that any Big Ten team, you know, ourselves in Indiana included, I mean, we should piss pound this team. I mean, this should be a 4-touchdown game. It should be over by the half. You know, Max Shortell should be playing the entire fourth quarter, right? Because they don't have the talent on offense, you know, or at least proven talent on offense. And they don't, you know, they're returning some nice guys on defense. You know, I think their defensive tackles are good. I think their linebacking core is also pretty good, but they just don't have any depth. Their depth is on defense is really pretty much non-existent, particularly in the secondary where you've got, you know, 3 freshmen in the 2 deeps there. So they don't have a lot of depth, but, you know, their starters are okay. But even there, Marquise Gray should, for all intents and purposes, be able to win this game by himself. I mean, there's nobody on that team that stacks up athletic-wise to Marquise Gray. And quite frankly, you know, just looking at our offensive line, we're significantly larger than UNLV's defensive line. That should open things up for the running game. That should mean that Gray has more time to find open receivers. So, you know, I think offensively, again, we stack up pretty well against UNLV defensively. But there again, you know, there were times last year where our offense was bad. And this is the first game of the season. You never know what's going to happen. Kill talked about it in the presser yesterday. We've got an awful lot of unproven wide receivers, so who knows how that's going to go. You know, everyone's been talking about Rabe and how much he's going to be utilized, but he only caught about 4 or 6 passes last year, I think. So it's not as if he was, you know, a prime target with receptions. So there isn't anyone who is proven to be able to catch the ball consistently. So I like all the reports that I heard from practice. You know, I think it's certainly Harbison seems like he's going to be a star here. McDonald is catching on pretty well. You know, A.J. Barker has had his praises sung for the last few days. So I think we've got a good nucleus of receivers, but similar to UNLV, all of them are really untested. All of them really haven't proven themselves to be able to do anything. So getting that first game out of the way, I think, is going to tell us a lot. And I don't want to use this game and say, well, if we don't win by four touchdowns, you know, the season's a failure. Oh, woe is me. And then, you know, drink myself to death in my shower. But at the same time, you know, I would like to be able to see us move the ball consistently, similar to what we did against, you know, Iowa last year, against Michigan State, against Illinois. If we're more like that than we are, you know, in some of the earlier games we played last year, I'll leave feeling pretty good. But, you know, again, this is a team, this UNLV team is a team that we should be able to absolutely handle. So it'll be interesting to see, given it's the first game of the season, if we're able to do that.
And let me just add to that, that if Marquise plays anywhere close to what he did against Michigan State, against this UNLV team, we are going to win by over four touchdowns. I mean, it's just simply, they do not have the type of horses that are going to be able to come back from quarterback who can eviscerate, which was what was the number one defense in the country at that point. And who is consistently keeping his eyes downfield and making really big pass plays, and who also has the ability to scramble for yards when he needs to, or in the just the simple quarterback run game where he can be able to just pound away for 7-8 yards a carry. Getting back to your point, remember what we were saying two podcasts ago about DiNardo and his quote from watching Gopher practice when he said, if the Gophers can develop an effective QB running back run game, that we will win all matchups. And what I think he's talking about is that our skill position players are better, are underrated, and to the point where, so DiNardo was talking about how they were underrated. John DeSue himself, Dean Hurt, was saying that we have the most underrated collection of skill position players in the conference. And that if teams are stacking 8 or 9 men in the box against Gray, that he is good. He has matured and improved his accuracy enough on his passes that they are not going to be able to stop with just too high or one, you know, cover one safety on these types of receivers. It's just not going to be possible for them. So it is imperative for me that in this game that we develop that Donnell Kirkwood and James Gillum, or maybe even Devin Wright or KJ May, can pressure the defense enough to where they have to overcommit to stopping that. So that, I think that is going to be the real key test.
Also, I feel like with the running game, it's if they say they had a collection of backs and you know, 300 yards rushing, I wouldn't grab as much from that as much as I would if they play really poorly, I guess. If the Gophers absolutely can't run the ball, if the offensive line isn't creating holes or creating space, then I'm really worried kind of moving ahead. But I think you guys hit it right on the head, whereas as far as moving forward this season, for what this offensive philosophy is, or what these guys, you know, what Lime Grover and Kill have done in the past, they're going to have to run the ball other than with Marquise Gray. And so to see Gillum or see Kirkwood or see Cobb or, you know, May, to see them emerge and consistently, not necessarily on, you know, if you want to call them gadget plays, or, you know, not necessarily just a 40-yard run that kind of skews stats, but just to see consistent running each drive would be really nice. Or that's something I guess I'm hoping for, or looking for this Thursday.
Yeah, I think we are going to run, and we are going to run, and we are going to run against UNLV. I don't see, you know, to MV's point, they may stack the box with 9, in which case, you know, we're probably going to throw a little play action with them. But, you know, first game of the season, you know, there's a decent chance the playbook is going to be, you know, more compressed than it is going to be later in the season, especially as you're trying to work in some new guys. So I think it's going to be run, run, run. And Elliot, to your point, if we can't consistently run the ball against UNLV, I'm concerned. Running is something that is, generally speaking, easier to do with the amount of time and you know, work that's been put in with the offensive line. I certainly think we've got the talent there now to be able to move the ball consistently against anyone, but can we execute against it? And that was the problem last year, is that I think we had some of the horses out there, but we're never able to really execute. You know, even in some of our better games, we still had issues trying to run the ball when it wasn't Marquise Gray. So let's talk a little bit about our running backs. You know, I am of a belief that we don't have what you would really consider to be a go-to workhorse back on this roster. I think we all had hopes and dreams that James Gillum was going to be that guy. But then you had Fuller Gaze come out this week where Kill basically came out and complimented Donnell Kirkwood on the camp that he'd had, and more or less suggesting, although he didn't say it, Fuller suggested that Kirkwoodland had now worked his way up to be the starting running back. Now, I don't think that's the end of the world. I like Kirkwoodland. He's kind of a fat guy. I like to get to the table. If I were going to be a running back, I would want to be like Kirkwood. But at the same time, I don't think that he's a guy who is going to be a game changer for you. So I guess the question to you guys is do we have a guy who's going to be able to consistently move the ball at running back, or are we going to be a running back by committee and are just going to have to live with the 3.5 to 4.5 yards a carry and be done with it?
You know, ever since I went to practice one day and I saw Gillum just pound the ball up the middle on the first day that the pads came on, and just be able to just basically will himself to like a 12-yard gain, even though he had about 20 tacklers trying to bring him down. You know, I really saw at that moment what it was that the coaching staff just really loved and raved about him for like the last, I don't know, the entire offseason, and why it was that they recruited him at two different locations. You know, he's just a really tough, and Kill made this point, he is a physically and mentally tough running back. And one of the things he does is that he always falls forward. He never gets pushed backward. He falls forward. He gets extra yards. He keeps his legs moving. I can turn out every single cliche that I have for a really powerful back I'm basically going to it. But he's that type of back. He's not flashy. He's a grinder. He's not a slasher. He's a guy that's really patient, running behind his blocks, and then once he gets the daylight, he will just simply grind. You know, one of the things that I would say about Kirkwood is he's a bowling ball. But the problem I have with him is that I don't think he's necessarily, in the past, he was the most patient back, nor did he have the type of vision that you would want. I mean, there were multiple times last year where he had only had a safety to beat, and if he had just made a simple cut to the inside or to the outside, he would have gained probably about another 20 yards. But instead, his prerogative was just to run the safety over, and he ended up getting tackled at that point and only gained probably about an additional 2 or 3 yards on top of it. You know, I think that's the point. So Kirkwood is a type of back that's really a better option when you don't have necessarily a great offensive line or a developing offensive line, because he makes really quick decisions and he sticks with them. So he'll pick a gap that he's going to attack and he'll just run right through it. He's not going to be a guy that's going to kind of slide and try and pick and choose a gap like a Bennett would be, nor is he a type of guy that's going to, you know, slash through them and, you know, kind of make the cutback. He's basically a one-cut-and-go type of guy, so which is great if you don't have a very good offensive line. You'll be able to get probably around like 3.5 to 4 carries doing that. But if this offense is going to move forward, they need a little bit more dynamism out of their running back position. They need to be able to get to that second level. Now, a sort of related point to this about that I'm sort of interested to see against UNLV are the line splits. One of the things that the coaching staff changed last year was they really tightened up their line splits pretty much after the Purdue game, and that closes down the amount of real estate that you're between the gaps for your running back. But it also keeps everything more contained so that your tackles can, you know, better pass block, and it's going to improve the pocket, so to speak, in pass protection. But it sort of limits what you can do from a rushing perspective. So I'm curious to see if they widen those splits up more, or if they're just going to be more compressed with there again, because our offensive linemen are still technically developing and they're still relatively young.
I'm going more off of that. I feel like Gillum he's not going to be a guy that is going to blow you away with the speed or something like that. But like you said, he's a grinder, like a name that, I guess from reading things about him or seeing him on film, kind of like Terry Allen when he was with the Vikings, where he was I guess that would be a high-end scenario in that, where his speed wasn't, you know, the greatest, but he could just get yards. He could keep throwing the ball and he'd hold on to it, he'd get yards. Kirkwood makes me worry a bit for, what was it, Purdue, where he had the 2 fumbles last year, and he never really ascended last year when there was a time when, you know, they obviously needed someone to kind of step up, and he, you know, never really kind of was able to do so. Granted, he was a redshirt freshman. A little bit before we're talking about, I'm really interested to see KJ May, though, just in, you know, granted he'll be kind of in certain packages and things like that. But I'm interested to see how they use him, or if he can kind of be that change of pace where they can use Gillum and Kirk Woodland and then throw May in as a change of pace. I'm really interested to do that. Also, I love the Kirk Woodland only because I have a friend that would always get Kirkland, the Kirkland beer from Costco. I'm trying to remember the different brands they had. But he would always get like, they had an Oktoberfest, but I forget what that was called. They had four different ones or so. But I appreciate that. Was Brian Bennett the one that called him?
No, it was actually the announcer for on ESPNU.
Oh, okay. That's about right then. Okay.
Broth, do you want to handle that?
I think May is one of those guys who really has some outstanding potential. And I'm just a cliche machine while I get my thoughts in order here. I don't think we're going to see as much from him as maybe some fans would like. We've heard an awful lot about him. I had an opportunity to see him in practice a couple of times. He's fast. He's shifty. He's one of those guys that really has the kind of game-breaking dynamism that you like to see from running back. So I think the future is really, really bright for him. But given the fact that, you know, he's been a gopher now for all of about a month, I doubt very seriously that he's learned enough of the scheme to be a regular player. So I think there are going to be packages where you see him out there. He may be lined up in a two-back set. He may be lined up as a slot back, which I think is to MV. I think you made this point. I completely agree. I think he's going to be our slot back. He's our Boise State guy who's going to fill a few different roles for us, but really just allow us to use his speed. So, you know, I think he's going to get some run. He may be a kickoff returner, maybe a punt returner for us. I know he's been getting some run in special teams groups. I think we're not going to see a heck of a lot of him as an offensive player for the first few weeks, at least. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe he's every bit as dynamic as we expect him to be, and he's ready to go right now. But I would suspect that given the fact that he's had a month to absorb and they've been running him at both running back and wide receiver, that he probably, you know, he certainly isn't big or physical enough to be able to pick up run blitzes. And we know that that's important to the staff since they've more or less moved David Cobb down to, you know, the third or fourth string simply because of his inability to pick up the blitz packages. So I don't think you're going to see May capable of doing that. So they're probably not going to put him out there as a single back. I think we're going to see maybe three or four offensive plays with KJ May in there. They may let him get a handoff, or they may run a wheel route or a quick little bubble screen out to him to see what happens. But I think his biggest impact for the first few weeks is going to be on special teams.
I completely agree with this. I think that if you're going to put a player like KJ May and you're stating right now that you're not going to redshirt him, that he's going to play, realistic expectations are that he's probably going to touch the ball maybe three or four times a game. I hesitate to even go to five, you know, touches a game, because I think that seems like an awful lot. So three or four times a game, maybe he'll get one or two carries either on a jet sweep, or like as Frothy said, they could put him on a bubble screen or a wheel route. Those are the types of really effective plays that you can utilize his speed. And at the same time, they're going to do stuff like that with Devin Wright as well. You know, Lime Grover has made the statement last week when he was on a podcast, I believe, with Tom Pelissero, or maybe it was Fun. I can't remember. He mentioned that they are going to do a lot more this season to attack the edges of the defense and try and get their speed towards, you know, get their speed moving more horizontally. Now, what I took that to mean was they are going to run more jet sweeps because they didn't do that a whole lot last year. They're going to run more pin and pull into the boundary. They're going to do some more runs with their speed, get more of their athletes in space and try and run stuff to the field side. And see what happens in that regard. So that's where KJ May, Marcus Jones, Devin Wright, that's where those type of players are going to be utilized. And I think the staff has really kind of hinted and dropped enough hints to where we can sort of expect that. I don't know how much of it that's going to happen, but it's definitely going to be something you need to be an eye on. I would not be surprised at all if we see in the neighborhood of 5 to 6 plays per game go towards, you know, of that type of nature, either a jet sweep, you know, bubble screen, you know, runs with some of their fast guys into the boundary, or maybe even a quick wide receiver screen or jailbreak, those type of things.
Yeah. So let's, so, okay. What can we realistically expect from the offense? My belief is that we're going to probably run 60 to 70% of the time, that we're going to run our stable of backs through and our go for running back Bukkake. And that, you know, I think, you know, Gray could very, very easily end up with 100 to 150 yards rushing. I think you supplement that with 100 to 150 yards rushing from our stable of running backs. And that's going to be the, we may have 150 yards passing, but not significantly more than that. Is that how we think things are going to shake out, or do either you feel like our offense might go in a different direction?
I think that's fairly realistic, I guess. I mean, I don't see the passing game just coming out and just winging it around, I guess. But just going off what we said, I'd really like them to see them just try to pound the ball and establish the running game to see if that's something this team can do moving forward. But MV, go ahead.
Here's what I'm going to say about this. UNLV's defense is probably going to be at the same level as New Mexico State's was last year. Now, remember that we put up over 400 yards against New Mexico State. It didn't look like it because we made a lot of just a huge amount of mental mistakes in that game, including two turnovers from Gray, one of which was directly led to a 14-point swing in the red zone, and then another led to another New Mexico State touchdown. We couldn't convert on fourth and one multiple times.
Did McKnight drop a touchdown in that game?
McKnight dropped a pass from short tail. That would have put us down into the red zone and probably put us in position to score again.
Okay.
Can't remember if Hawthorne missed a field goal in that game. So we realistically left about 17 points or so on the table in that game. Now, having said that, Gray ran for 110 yards in that game. And we had, like I said, we had over 400 yards of total offense in that game, even though it didn't look like it. It was probably one of our sloppiest games all season. In all likelihood, we'll put up over 400 yards again against UNLV, unless something terrible happens. The only reason why I see we won't put up a ton of yards on them is if we just, to Frothy and Elliott's point, we just decide to pound, pound, pound. We're going to do a replication of Middle Tennessee back in 2010, where we run the ball 50-plus times a game, and we don't let Marquise throw the ball that much at all, and we're just going to grind the clock, pound away, you know, and just suck the clock down, you know, to nothing. Now, I will say that if Lime Grover and Kill want to get this game over quickly, as in they want to be up three touchdowns at half, they should pass the ball, because UNLV's defense is brutal, especially on pass defense. They don't have the athletes at corner or at safety that can win matchups against, you know, a 6'3 Andre McDonald of Isaac Frickte or, you know, Devin Crawford Tufts. We simply have, you know, more athleticism, even though we are really young at receiver. We should be able to win these matchups. And I think that I believe from everything that I've seen and read from practice that Marquise is going to be improved enough where he can be able to hit those receivers. And simply, one of the common denominator for huge upsets from lower level FBS teams against AQ conference teams, or from FCS teams to AQ conference teams, is they keep these teams around. They allow these lower, you know, less talented teams to just stick around these games, and they sort of build confidence as they go along. The quickest way to stop a quelling uprise of an upset is to just humiliate and demoralize a team like this right away. So if Gray throws for two quick, leads to really two really quick touchdown scores at the beginning of this game, and the defense sort of holds serve, and the offense can get up by two to three touchdowns before halftime, I think UNLV is going to be pretty demoralized. And I, quite frankly, they do not have the sort of quick strike ability on their team to win a game in a shootout like this. So once it gets in the second half, I mean, they're just going to try and run the ball and grind it. So, but if we go on that along those same lines, if we try to match UNLV on the ground and just try to, we both are sitting here trying to ground, I think this game can be a little bit closer than most Gopher fans would be comfortable with.
I feel like I'd be happy with any win, being that I've watched this team lose to just about every single Dakota team there is. I would be happy with a 10-point win, I guess. I mean, granted that, you know, there's the disparities in talent and that sort of thing, but again, as far as I'm concerned, a win is a win. But I'd like to see it in a comfortable 10-point region where, you know, they've been running the ball and UNLV never necessarily gets very close. But Frothy, what are you expecting from the game, or how close do you expect this one to come out?
God, I mean, I want to say that it's a 3-touchdown victory and the game is hand at the half. I don't think it's going to shape up that way.
And you're walking down the strip screaming at people, throwing cups at them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I could go into full drug rage mode and just berate all 17 of UNLV's fans. Speaking of which, their online presence is, oh my God, it's just a barren wasteland. I found one board, a rivals board, where there were some UNLV fans on there, and I asked them kind of what they thought, and I got about 3 responses, and one of the responses was asking me to bring some lake fish down. So there is not a great deal of excitement around UNLV football. I think that it's going to be a close game. I think the Vegas line is probably about right in the 7-10 range. The line may creep up a little bit more up to, say, 11 or 12, but I don't think it'll go any higher than that. Optimistically, I don't think that they – I mean, I think that we have significantly better athletes than they do, as we should. I think that we have the far and away the best athlete on the field on our team who's going to be touching the ball on every single offensive play. I think that, you know, their program is really, really bleak. I mean, I I'm not going to give them any bulletin board material, but it's been a rough last several years for them. And they've got a lot of new guys coming in this year at really, really key positions. And I just don't see how they can, you know, on paper, they shouldn't be able to hang with us, and we should comfortably walk away with it. You know, again, on paper, we should have piss pounded New Mexico State. We should have piss pounded North Dakota State. Obviously, that didn't happen. But it wouldn't surprise me if this game is still in doubt with 5 to 7 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And it wouldn't surprise me that we win in the 3 to 7 point range. It's just, again, first game of the season. You don't know what you're going to get. I really, really hope I'm wrong. But I think this is going to be a far, far closer game than any Gopher fan would be comfortable with.
Just to jump in quick, the win has the line at 8.5. It moved down to 7.5 at one point, but Gopher's 8.5. And I'm not a big gambling guy. The last significant bet that I made was betting $20 that Reggie Bush would be the first pick overall, and we all know how well that went. So,
you know, I, as an aside, I would say that this line falls into a classic sharp arbitrage bet, where the line opened up at, you know, -12 for the Gophers. The Sharps bet UNLV heavy, 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 and they beat the line down to 7.5, at which point they went back, so then they switched their bet again to the Gophers. So basically, in layman's terms, if the Gophers win anywhere between 8 and 11 points in this game, which I think a lot of people, including ourselves, are talking about as the probable range of this victory, that they're going to win on both sides of it. So they'll get basically double their money for it. And they won't end up losing. The only time where they end up losing would be if UNLV basically wins this game, which I don't think that is going to happen there. But I will say this about comparing this game to previous matchups against opponents who shouldn't even be in the same discussion as the Gophers. Now, again, this is going to sound homeristic and like a lot of excuses, but I think New Mexico State last year was the product of the fact that they had just beaten, or they had nearly beaten USC at home in week one and played out of their minds, and USC basically did nothing in the second half. So they got really overconfident in that game, and then they just simply didn't play well against New Mexico State. They moved the ball a decent amount. Their athleticism and superior talent showed, but they made way too many mental mistakes. They couldn't convert on really simple fourth down plays and just basically coughed it up. North Dakota State was a game which was essentially tied for the entire game. We matched North Dakota State in offensive output basically the whole game, and the difference was two interception returns for touchdowns, one of which was beyond a fluke. It was probably the flukiest. Oh, that was
awful.
It was the
fluke. I just threw something.
It was the flukiest play in all of my Gopher fandom that I could possibly remember, and I have seen a lot of flukes. I mean, I have seen Jamal Harris fumble a kickoff or a blocked field goal for a touchdown. I've seen Gary, Tinsley, rest in peace, brother. I've seen him return a touchdown only to fumble it off a pylon.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, but I cannot possibly imagine a more improbable outcome than North Dakota State's into fumble touchdown return.
I can remember one play that's similar. It's on a Gopher. It was a Vikings-Packer game in like 2000, 2001. I think it was Robert Brooks or Antonio Freeman. I want to say it was Brooks, but that might even be wrong. But it was like it was in overtime, I believe. Or it like bounced off someone's foot and then like hit their pad, and then he caught it and like just picked it up and ran. And it was kind of one of those things where.
Yeah, I remember that play. I can't remember who it was, but they caught the ball, a fairly deep pass, and then instead of touching the ground, he basically rolled over a Viking defensive back's, back.
Yeah, he basically rode a unicorn over water, and then somehow it was just obscene. And that was that North Dakota State thing was like, you couldn't even scream because I didn't even just understand what I just saw. Like, I had to, TiVo it back and then start screaming and throwing things and cussing because I was, it was like, wait, did that really just happen? Yeah, of course it just happened. Oh, it was garbage.
Yeah, so again, those were, so I'm, basically, yes, I am. I am making excuses for what happened last year. And I am in the same vein, South Dakota in 2010 was an excuse because I know from people talking on the inside with that the Gophers didn't spend, the coaching staff spent zero time prepping for South Dakota in that game. They were spending all of their time prepping for USC coming up the following week. This is the brilliance of Tim Brewster, to actually do not – figuratively look ahead. They literally were looking ahead to USC the following week, and then they just were completely unprepared for anything that South Dakota had done. I think I can't remember if this is true or not, but they didn't even get game film until like a few days before they were supposed to play them, so they had no idea what to expect. Yeah, I mean you could go down the same lines again that we always find ourselves in these trap game situations where we end up getting victimized because we simply. From one situation scenario or another are overlooking the opponent. And I quite frankly do not see that happening in a season opener. If there is any game on the schedule in which you are going to be your absolute most prepared, it is going to be the season opener. I expect no overlooking UNLV, especially from this coaching staff, which knows very well that a lesser talented team can beat a Big Ten team if they play their cards right.
And especially with this coaching staff, we hear so much about they're overachievers and Minnesota's got the right guy in Jerry Kill. And if, last year, the two very winnable games that they dropped that we've talked about in depth, I don't want to touch on anymore. if they lose to UNLV to open the season, that's, I would think, at least a red flag in that then maybe the narrative of Jerry Kill doesn't fit. What people have been writing and what we've been saying that he's, this overachiever or, he's going to have this team that's not going to shit the bed, I guess, for lack of a better term. So as you said, a setback down the road, if they lose to Syracuse, yeah, I can see that. But a loss to UNLV, I would be even more surprised just being it's the first game of the season. And you're, like you said, you're the most prepared for this game essentially than any other thing on the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry Kill's here for the next years, regardless of what happens on the field, in my opinion. With that said,
oh sure,
I absolutely positively would not rationalize a loss to UNLV, and there wouldn't be any moral victories. If we lose 54 to 51 in a Purdue style shootout. And our offense was absolutely brilliant. And, any questions about Marquise's ability to throw the ball are gone when he, throws a Dan Persa 78% completion clip. that would all be absolutely meaningless if our defense gave up, you know, 54 points to UNLV. You know, I don't see us losing this game, but the UNLV fans don't see them losing this game. They think that this is absolutely a winnable game for them, and they were talking, you know, ridiculous amounts of smack about how, you know, their program is turning around. They're saying exactly the same things that we are and expect to win this game every bit as much as we expect to win this game. So, yeah, Jerry Kill's going to be here regardless of how this game turns out for the next 2 years. But you're right, Elliot. It would send a big red flag up if we lose this game to UNLV.
Well, it's just like you're saying. It's just Northwestern thing. You know, no one looks on the schedule at Minnesota and says, "Oh, we'll lose to them." Just the same way, you know, we don't look at UNLV and think, "Oh, yeah, of course the Gophers are going to lose to UNLV." So, I mean, everyone always kind of pencils that win in. But if people, you know, some people saying that this team could possibly go bowling. You know, this is the essential type of game they need to win, and really they should. But I'm really interested to see the new secondary and then the running backs and see how they play and how they kind of, I guess, grow from last year.
You know, one of the things that I find interesting about this matchup is that there are so many similarities and there's a lot of interconnectivity between Bobby Hauk and Jerry Kill. I mean, they were both phenomenal coaches at the FCS level. I mean, Montana is a legitimate powerhouse. If you could think of, you know, one or two franchises or programs at the FCS level that are consistently among the top five, Montana has got to be up there at the top with a bullet. But that said, it's sort of interesting the route that they took. You know, Kill, every time Kill has moved up, it seems as if the situation in which he's moved up, he's quickly able to adapt to the situation and know exactly what that program needs at that time. So when he joined Southern Illinois, Southern Illinois was a tire fire filled with inside of a dumpster with burning used soil diapers. It was horrible, and they kicked off probably about 30 or 40 players that first year, simply because they just weren't ready to. They just weren't going to buy into the program, and he built that team into legitimately one of the best in the FCS. I mean, that deserves all of the praise that Kill has actually received at this point. But I find it interesting that both of these guys were phenomenal coaches, but Kill's route has been a lot different than Hauk's route. So Kill has always overachieved and outworked and sort of worked his way up through the coaching ranks, starting from Division II and then getting up to the Big Ten level, whereas Hauk was sort of a guy that was a Rick Neuheisel disciple and kind of bounced around between Colorado and Washington before settling back into a program that already had an established football culture in Montana. And then from there, he sort of left Montana when they were just about on the precipice of winning another FCS national title and went to arguably one of the five worst programs in all of FBS, in all of the football subdivision. So it's weird to kind of think about it in those terms beyond the similarities in offensive style and the success they had at that level. Is Hauk going to be able to turn this program around? He might. I will say that he's a very good coach. He's saying all the right things. He has the pedigree to do it in the past. But the difference, I think, between him and Kill is that Kill literally transports his program from each location to the next, and that causes immediate buy-in, especially when it so happens in Kill's perspective that his Northern Illinois team beat Minnesota. His Southern Illinois team beat Northern Illinois before he transferred over there, and he sort of gets that reputation. Hauk, I don't know. I mean, Hauk has a reputation as being a bit of an asshole. I mean, he legendarily got into big, big fights with the student newspaper over the lack of discipline and the amount of criminal activity that happened among his Montana players. In fact, one of them is actually charged with murder. So that's going to be interesting to see. I think that's a kind of a underrated storyline that hasn't been discussed up to this point.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right on. But I think the things that they're saying and their approach to it are very, very consistent. And, you know, We talked about this a little bit on the Twitter, the similarities between the two programs. Both of them are arguably in the top and the bottom five in their respective divisions. You know, ours within BCS conferences, theirs within the non-AQ, still FCS or FBS conferences. You know, we're both, we've both got relatively new coaches. This will be Hawk's third year, Kill's second year. Both have, you know, fairly small but very passionate fan bases who believe that it shouldn't take as long as it has done to turn the program around. I mean, there's already a pretty significant amount of chatter about, you know, this is Hawk's last chance to do anything with it, which is pretty unbelievable given the state of the program. And it isn't, you know, turning a program around to some of the points that Kill made about turning Southern Illinois around and the relationship with Barry Alvarez when he went into Wisconsin. You could, you know, you could shit can 30 players and not take a hit. But, you know, in today's world with all the scores that the NCAA keeps track of, you lose scholarships if you ditch 30 players from your team. But, you know, there are an awful lot of similarities, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether Hauk has an opportunity in year three. You know, it's arguable, you know, I think most people would probably say 4 or 5 years, but you should start to see the coach's fingerprint on the program. And, you know, he's putting his money, he's taking a risk. I think as bad as Caleb Herring is as a quarterback, he was a junior, has had some experience in the system. He's taking a risk by going with a redshirt freshman. You know, it's his guy. He recruited him. That I'm sure factors into it, but it's a big risk, similar to where, you know, Brewster had Adam Weber, didn't play Marquise Gray at quarterback, even though he was his guy. He felt like Weber gave him the better chance to win. Hauk is taking the approach of starting the redshirt freshman quarterback instead of the junior quarterback, not necessarily because he gives him a better chance to win, though I'm sure he does believe that, but because I think he represents the future of the program. It's his guy, and wants to get him out there and see how things go. But I don't think that Hauk has an enormously long leash, certainly doesn't have the long leash that Jerry Kill has. But it'll be interesting to see these two guys who represent very similar programs going up against each other on Thursday.
Yeah, I think from Hauk's perspective, I don't know the ins and outs. You're not going to call me a UNLV running rebel, great mind. I wonder how much leash he does have from the UNLV administration. I know that. So obviously here, there is a huge amount of support from President Kaler and demigod Norwood Teague behind Jerry Kill. And I think the fact that he's locked up to a now 7-year deal, and he has 6 more years of the contract left, sort of lends itself to he's going to be here for the long haul, and it's okay if he doesn't try and do these shortcuts to try and win. You know, try and win games now, which would indicate stuff like if they were going after JUCO players Dan Snyder style every single year, or not Dan Snyder, Bill Snyder, every single year like they do at Kansas State. That said about Hauk, it's pretty clear that he is taking a nucleus of players that he has on offense, including his very good left tackle and center. And you're going to try and build around 3 years between this offensive line, Nick Sherry and Tim Cornett. That's going to be his offensive nucleus. Now, one thing I will say that's interesting about Hauk is that generally these lower level FCS, FBS teams like a UNLV generally don't try and recruit the type of schemes that he apparently is trying to install at UNLV. So. The type of players that you usually get at this level are really underdeveloped players that need a little bit of time to, you know, develop and grow into their bodies if you're going to get them in the kind of prototypical offensive line range, like in the 6'7" or so spot. So you either get really undersized players along the offensive line, and you go the Western Michigan spread, you know, pass happy, we're just going to attack the field at all costs type of offense. He's really going for a more traditional, you know, power-based offensive line, similar to what Kill has run basically his whole career. And the interesting thing about that is this is generally not something that works at the lower levels. But now it worked famously for Kill at Northern, and he's implementing that same style here at Minnesota, and that's more of a what you would traditionally expect out of a Big Ten team that's able to get Big Ten athletes like this. But I'm curious to see if Hauk can actually pull this off. They have some good building blocks, but you know, if they don't make significant progress this year, I think Hauk is definitely going to be on the hot seat in year four and probably going to be out, and they might be starting over in 2 years' time.
Well, I wanted to switch gears a bit, guys. For those of us not going to Vegas, wanted to make sure people realize. So the game's going to be on the CBS Sports Network. Is that the one? So I actually have to go up on my cable package. Do you get that MV?
Yes. From years of overpaying for cable, I have found out a couple of weeks ago that I actually do have CBS Sports Network because I turned it on and they were playing Auburn versus Alabama in 2010. So I was quite thrilled with this. This is literally the exact same scenario that I was trying to figure out back in 2010 as to whether I got ESPNU. And I found out that it was part of the upper tier sports package. So hooray, wasting money on cable.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I just wanted to make sure I didn't have to listen to the radio feed again when I was in Kansas for we lived there for a couple of months, and I was the South Dakota game I had to listen to on the South Dakota radio feed, actually, because WCCO cuts out after a half, and some of the other tiers, I can't get them. But I was hoping it'd be locally on a different channel, but it really doesn't matter either way as long as it's on TV, I guess.
Is that like the Breaker One feed in Kansas to play the South Dakota Minnesota game? I mean, were you in like rural Kansas where you have to get like?
No, we were in Wichita. My wife had a job there. There was like a fellowship that was split there, and then part of it was overseas. And so we didn't have where we lived was part of the stipend from the job, so we didn't have a cable box.
Ah.
So we didn't have BTN. So usually you could go on, on the internet, you can get most of the games. And did that fine, but for, you know, that game there was probably about seven people outside of South Dakota and Minnesota that wanted to actually see that game. So yeah, I had to listen to the radio feed on that one. So it was just basically touchdown Yotes every three seconds. And I still remember, yeah, there was a scramble on it. I think like either a fourth down for a touchdown or a third down that I can still remember. I mean, I know I've said this on Twitter at least 17 times, but it sounded like someone gave birth in the. In the studio, but so glad I won't have to go through that. Yeah. But that again,
coincidentally, I gave birth in that play as well, but it wasn't like a birth, so to speak. It was a shadow monster like Melisandre from Game of Thrones, where the shadow monster of all my gopher angst.
Hey, we gotta talk about Tim Brewster.
So the shadow monster of, we'll get to Brewster, the shadow monster of all my gopher angst and hatred manifested itself out and then came and stabbed Tim Brewster in the back.
we gotta talk about Mississippi State. We gotta talk about Hail State.
Okay, Bruce, I think Froth should handle this one because I might have a propensity to go a little bit too frontal on this, but yeah, you go ahead, Frothy.
Yeah, so I think in the podcast a couple of weeks ago, I made it a point to say that I don't hate Tim Brewster, right? Yeah. I believe I said that, and it's on the record. You can go back and take a look at it. So I will qualify everything I'm about to say by 2 weeks ago, I didn't hate Tim Brewster. Now, and I'm going to go a little salty here, I fucking hate Tim Brewster.
Big man's game. Seriously. Go dominate.
Seriously. You're going to go out on your first day of the new job at fucking Mississippi State where they were absolutely desperate to hire someone after they shit-canned their other wide receiver coach for recruiting irregularities, right? So they go out and find this guy. And I understand he's probably jazzed, right? I mean, it's been a couple of years after he got canned here for turning our program into a goddamn diaper fire. So then he goes to Mississippi State. And what's one of the first thing he says? Well, it's going to be easier to recruit here at Mississippi State than it was in Minneapolis. Seriously, brother, you're going to come at us and say that, well, yeah, it sure is tough to recruit there. Maybe it was tough for you to recruit here because you burned the entire program to the ground. We have been an absolute wasteland for the last 2 years strictly because of him, right? Now, I understand he sure tried his heart out. He put all everything into it. That 2008 recruiting class was absolutely brilliant. Yep, I agree with absolutely every lick of that. But at the same time, he was an awful football coach. Absolutely awful. Couldn't hold on to any coordinators. To your point earlier, MV, getting ready for the South Dakota game. What are they doing? Well, they're not getting ready for the South Dakota game. They're getting ready for the USC game the following week. So the team is woefully underprepared, and not for the first time, and certainly not for the last time, absolutely humiliated by a BC by an FCS team, right? So, yeah, okay, great. Thanks, Tim Brewster. You know, I made this point on Twitter right away. I think the issue with Tim Brewster recruiting to Minneapolis wasn't Minneapolis. It was Tim Brewster and the fact that he didn't have a vision. He didn't have any idea what the hell he was trying to do. He was all sizzle, no steak. And again, 2 weeks ago, I didn't hate the guy. Now that guy is absolutely on my shit list, and I give it about 2 weeks until he, like Glenn Mason, blocks me on Twitter.
It's real. It's raw. At times, it's real raw.
I just like when he when Jimmy Jerry had to retire and Tim Brewster sent him a message on Twitter and completely mangled his name and didn't delete and re-edit, just fuck it. There it is. I'm a coach. Is leader of men, and I'm just going to mangle your name in supposedly a somewhat emotional moment.
So here's what I'm going to say about Tim Brewster. All right, I actually do hate what Tim Brewster did to our program. I hold a lot of ill will towards him because he took what was a team that as much as bad things as we can. So, but basically, this is what I hate about Tim Brewster. Tim Brewster has made us sort of like Glenn Mason again. And we hated Glenn Mason towards the end of his tenure. He was a pompous, aloof jerk in press conferences. The school didn't like him. They wanted to get rid of him. They found every excuse they could in 2006 to get rid of this guy. And then when they finally did, they had no plan whatsoever. I hate the fact that he has made us like that guy and make us yearn for the days in which we were getting blown out by a hungover Mike Leach. You know? So, I mean, that's what I hate the most about Tim
Brewster. I find it really interesting that the one thing I read about the story said that, and I don't know if this is necessarily true or not, I forget which publication it was in, but that Brewster reached out to Mississippi State, that they needed someone so bad, and he just called and, you know, kind of, where do you need me? I'll show up.
Oh, see, it's
just kind of, it shows I guess how desperate Mississippi State was to fill that job.
But let's talk about this for a second, too, that no, given Brewster's career arc, if he had never been a head coach before, a move from tight end special teams coach up to wide receivers would constitute a promotion. That's actually more responsibility within the offense and something that's far more integral to an offensive scheme than simply coaching tight ends, which are basically spend half of their time with the offensive line coach and then half the time with the wide receiver coach as it is. So, I mean, they have to have a little bit of both, but Brewster has never developed a wide receiver in his life, okay? He's only in Mississippi State because they needed somebody a week before the season started, okay? So to all these Mississippi State rubes saying, oh, you know, it's great, Dan Mullen is, you know, typically gets these guys who are great recruiters and then he'll coach them up, blah, blah, blah. No, Tim Brewster is not a good hire for you. I doubt sincerely that Tim Brewster is going to be your wide receiver coach beyond 2 years. Because he's simply not good at this. Now, I've heard many of people in the coaching industry say that, oh, Tim Brewster is a phenomenal position coach. Well, I'll believe it when I see it, okay? If Mississippi State's wide receivers light up the SEC, then I'll be able to eat my words, you know, have a little plate of crow, and then, you know, give Brewster his props. But until then, he is an unrelenting, self-serving blowhard. I mean, this guy was talking about how, oh, man, I got off the golf course, you know, I had to pause myself on the fifth tee and then head on a plane back to Starkville. Well, yeah, I'm sure your new wide receivers and recruits in Mississippi were so thrilled that you took the time out of your day to get on a plane and interrupt your golf session. I mean, come on.
Didn't he have the helicopter?
Yeah.
Zinger.
Here's the thing. Tim Brewster may grow up one day to be the greatest coach on earth, right? It's not, you know, stranger things have happened barely, but stranger things have happened, right? So, you know, if he wants to get back into coaching, good for him, more power to him. But, you know, it's probably not the greatest thing in the world to take a place that gave him such an opportunity that the University of Minnesota gave him. Inadvisably, horrific decision from a business and practical standpoint, but they gave him that opportunity to come in and coach a BCS conference team when he, by all rights, should have never had an opportunity to do it. it takes some serious fucking classlessness to then go and basically throw insults back at that same place that gave you that opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a, and it's an absolute piss on all the fans who, myself included, bought into his hype, supported him, argued with people who thought he was a complete fucking moron, and they were right, right? But it's a slap in the face to those of us who, in and out, have supported that program, stuck up for him, you know, even after some of just the horrific losses, right? It really wasn't until Northern Illinois where I said, okay, it's finally time, we got to get rid of him, right? So I stuck with him through quite a bit. And then for him to come out and throw that shit about, oh, it was real tough to recruit up to Minnesota, show it up your ass.
Get your dadgum chili hot, right, boys? Get that chili hot.
Now touching on other coaches we're actually happy to see back in the game. Just quickly, in the Pac-12, I'm really excited to see Mike Leach in Washington State. Who else are you guys looking at? Because I like the Pac-12 if you can get that late game on as well. I can't wait for the – do Leach and Rich Rod play each other this year in the Pac-12? Do they have unbalanced schedule? I don't know right offhand. But that would be a game I'd love to see because there will obviously be no defense. I might as well just play flag football. But who are you guys looking forward to see this year other than the Gophers?
I'll go ahead and start. Let's see here. Washington State does not play Arizona this year, unfortunately. They do play. Washington State does play Todd Graham and Arizona State on November 17th. So that actually might be a lot of fireworks. And I think every college football fan ever is excited to see Todd Graham just get his comeuppance after basically recycling.
Will he still be there at that point?
He may have already taken three other additional jobs at that point. Yeah. So, you know, beyond Leach is quintessential college football in my mind. I mean, he's an absolutely quirky.
Their fat little girlfriends are telling him what they want to hear.
You know, eccentric head coach that just dominates everywhere he goes, and he does it in a place, and he does it in the most non-traditional of places. I can't think of a better scenario than Mike Leach at running the Palouse. It's just fantastic for college football, and I'm really glad he's back in there. You know, getting more along those same lines, and basically in that same coaching tree family, I love Dana Holgorsen. I absolutely loved the Orange Bowl when he hung 70 on Clemson. I love the fact that this guy just chugs Red Bull, you know, puts up tons of points. He can install his offense in 3 days, and then he spends the rest of his time just getting wasted in a West Virginia casino. I mean, this is, again, quintessential college football figures and characters. There just doesn't get any better than that. Only in college football can a guy like Mike Leach and Dana Holgorsen be the awesome anti-heroes that they are. I mean, these guys are basically drifters living in hotels, getting drunk, but they're brilliant drifters.
Well, it's very much the kind of the Steve Spurrier, the I'm not going to sleep on the couch in my room, in my office type thing. It's like, you know, we're going to install the offense, we're going to score 70 points, and we're going to talk shit about the opponent, you know, our rivals on the way there, which you got to love.
Yeah, so I like to think, MV, that if we were to take me and you, so the bald part of my head, and then your fantastic long hair look that you got going on, and you know, we could be Dana Holgorsen. And I will be living, and I may hashtag this, I may be living Holgo life in Vegas this week when I'm getting wasted at a casino. So Holgo life it is. From my perspective, the first team I'm kind of interested in seeing this year is I'm going to shock the world and go with a Big East team. I'm really excited to see Louisville this year.
Louisville.
Yeah, I think that they're building a nice program there. And all the shit talk that's been going on leading up to next Sunday's UK Louisville game, I'm really interested to see how that shakes out. You know, I don't think Louisville isn't going to be challenging for a national championship or anything, but I think that they are probably the class of the Big East. And I think the Big East is more interesting now. I mean, I think with Chris out there at Pittsburgh, I think that'll be interesting. And you know, they're going to be about a 25 team conference before too much longer. So they've got to have one or two good teams when you're basically capturing about half the teams in the FBS. I think the Pac-12 is really interesting. The Pac-12 may be a much more likable version of the SEC
I think you've got a lot of talent out there, and you've got some great personalities in the coaches. You know, I was watching the Oregon State UCLA game on TV last night from last year, and a little tear came in my eye thinking that Rick Neuheisel won't be there anymore. And now NFL aides and the Mora family. So it'll be interesting to see what goes on there. You know, I generally have liked Big 12 football, so I'm interested to see if Texas can take any steps further since they've been down in the doldrums for the last few years. I think Oklahoma is looking like world beaters at this point. I'd be surprised if they weren't in the hunt for a national championship. But no, I can't wait. I'll be in the Las Vegas Hilton Sportsbook starting at about 7 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. Probably will be there until about 10 o'clock at night. Trying desperately to drink enough alcohol to purge all the water from my system, and I will be just an absolute husk of a man.
You know, getting back to the Big East, this is not something that's going to happen this year, but I'm really, really excited, you guys, to see Chris Peterson and Boise State basically make UConn look like New Mexico in about 2 or 3 years' time. I mean, that's going to be absolutely fantastic to see all these people who say that Boise State can't possibly, you know, replicate that sort of success when they play, again, if they played a real conference schedule. But now they're going to play teams that are probably slightly better than Nevada. You know, not to speak ill will against Chris Salt, because he actually runs a really good program, but that's going to be great. Can't wait for that.
Yeah, it'll be fine punishment for UConn sneaking into that BCS game not that long ago. Congratulations, 2 years ago you were actually in a BCS bowl, and now you're going to get your shit pushed in by Boise State.
Yeah, it's going to be hilarious. I mean, I love Boise State as a program. I think it's unbelievable, the football culture that they've built there. And it's basically self-sustaining football culture. It's kind of like Montana in that regard, where here's this place in the middle of damn nowhere. I mean, you have mountains in the background, and you have towny folk that just pile in by the, you know, about 30,000 to 40,000 town folk just pile into these like really unique looking stadiums and they somehow have turned into an intimidating program. I mean, hats off to Chris Peterson, but you know, at the same time, Boise State's been good at their relative level for a really, really long time. And winning,
true. They made a good call going into Big East as well. I think they'll have a lot more success in the Big East than say TCU will have for their first couple of years in the Big 12.
Yeah, I think TCU.
Yeah, definitely.
TCU is going to have some issues. I think simply because of the fact that, you know, there's going to be an adjustment period. You know, who knows? They may be awesome. I could be completely wrong about this, but I think kind of like Nebraska joining the Big Ten, they were not ready for the amount of physical offensive linemen that they were going to see, physical offensive linemen and tight ends that their defense saw in that conference. So it was a lot more of a challenge and transition than Nebraska would have liked. And I think the same thing is going to happen with TCU. You know, you can get away with playing a 4-2-5 where your third linebacker is basically, or you're playing a five-man nickel package on basically every snap, and your second, your third safety is basically a linebacker hybrid, you know, safety combo. But yeah, it's going to be I don't know how well they're going to be able to hold up doing that when you have to play against, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, and then Oklahoma State, you know, in back-to-back weeks. It's not to say that they can't compete against a team like Baylor, because they have been able to compete against a team like Baylor in the past. But it'll be fun. I think those are two of the more interesting storylines of college football this year, is to see how these new teams, how West Virginia and TCU handle the move to the Big 12. And what has now become a more interesting conference, I think, despite all the changes that have occurred in that conference over the last 2 years.
Yeah,
for sure. No, I think Texas A&M and Missouri, I think, are going to have some tough years ahead. I mean, well, obviously going to the SEC, but I think those would be interesting home and aways going, you know, to Boise State or TCU with, you know, Killen and Gary Patterson being as close as they are. Great, I don't think those will happen, but I think those would just be kind of fun games, or, you know, different places rather than, you know, maybe MAC schools or you know, New Hampshire, East Dakota.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I would love for this season to see a TCU Minnesota Meineke Car Care Bowl. I think that would be a absolutely fantastic way to kick off the program. I think that would there'd be some really nice built-in storylines there. You know, that we could probably type. People could talk about the Patterson Kill relationship. The probably you know Fuller and Team Beard would probably make a concurring columns on that, much like they do everything else. This just happens when you have two major newspapers in the same town.
Yep, and today's coverage is all about how Marquise Gray is a father now.
Yeah, on a side note, you know, as we're you know winding down the podcast here, I had no idea that Brian Cupido was actually a papa in his senior year of college.
No, I didn't know that. Yeah, I didn't know that. Either.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I didn't know that.
So yeah, they both the Pioneer Press and the Star Tribune ran with that storyline about how you know how difficult it is to be a father and a you know college quarterback at the same time. So they reeled in you know Cupido and talked about how he dealt with it. And his storyline was that he would actually use Matt Spaeth to babysit the kid while he and Cupido Cupido and his girlfriend who is now his wife had classes at night. So I thought that was a really interesting angle. I think from the way the narrative is playing out with Marquise and his twins and his budding family unit that he has going on with his fiance, it definitely plays more into this. Not only is Gray maturing on the field, the maturation has somehow come from within him himself, that he himself is a more mature person that's able to better handle responsibility. So he attacks everything with proper time management and giving everything the necessary focus it needs when it needs it, and he's focused less on the unimportant things that normal college students love to do, like go out and party after they win a football game.
You know what I'm most happy about, MV?
What's that?
It's game week, and we won't have any more human interest stories.
Yeah.
So with that said, let's run through a quick prediction segment. Let's predict the final score of our Minnesota Golden Gophers at the UNLV. Don't call them the Runnin' Rebels because apparently that's only used for the basketball team.
That's only used for basketball? If I was the Hawk, I'd bring that back for football.
Yeah, the media guide explicitly calls out. Again, this is based on the copious amounts of research.
Extensive.
Yeah, exactly. I'm now a UNLV expert.
I guess I'll go first because I just interrupted everyone. Give me 24-13 Gophers, I guess.
Okay.
And I'll go. I have no bait. Maybe 24-17 somewhere in there. I think.
All right, MV.
You know, all of my statistical wizardry has pumped out a model that has matched very closely with what the Vegas line is pointing out. I will say that. So here's what's interesting. I inputted the model first from when Caleb Herring was starting. And Caleb and the input for that model, based upon a returning starter and a returning quarterback, gave the margin at about 7.5. Now, again, I don't need to go into the details of what these statistical models actually mean and what they're actually measuring and how it outputs what they do. But them starting Nick Sherry bumped that prediction up to about the 9-point range. So I'm predicting a 29-20 Gopher victory. Although I do see a scenario in which this game can get out of hand and the Gophers can put it away very easily. This could be a situation where the Gophers get up by 2 touchdowns, maybe even 17 points, relatively early in the third quarter, and that UNLV gets a late touchdown to cover.
Got it. Yeah, so I'm going to continue with this new philosophy of very, very restrained optimism. I think that we're going to win. I think it'll be a pretty low-scoring affair. I see the final score as Gophers 17, UNLV 14. I think both teams have an awful lot of offensive growing pains to work through, and I don't see an awful lot of scoring to be had. I think both teams will move the ball fairly effectively, but will have trouble executing in the red zone. So again, 17-14. Last I saw the over was a few days ago. I think it was about 48.5, which I think is absolutely insane. That may be a testament to the relative weakness of the respective team's defense. But with as many new folks on both teams coming in on the offensive side of the ball, I just don't see an awful lot of points being scored. So 17-14 Gophers over UNLV. I really, really, really hope that I'm wrong and that we absolutely push their shit out.
You know what? That that over line is really interesting because so the over I think started at about 53.5 and then just continued to drop. And the last I saw was about 50.5. So now that if it's in the 48.5 range, woof, they do not expect a whole lot of offensive output in this game. I will say that my mathematical models have an average of about 55.5 as the over under for an average football game. So if you, no matter what inputs you have, it'll most of the time come out to be that range. Now, do I think it's going to be at 55.5? No. So, but I think there will be over 50 points scored in this game. I will leave it at that. I think it'll approach that level.
If we're pushing that over, if we're into the 50-point range, I think the Gophers win because I just feel like we're going to be the team that is capable of scoring more points. So I hope that you're right.
I completely agree with that. I think Elliot is clipping his nails right now.
Oh, no, I was messing with my computer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, can you hear that?
Yeah.
No, I was wrapping up the laptop was dead, so I'm actually on the other computer.
Okay. All right. Well, that part will get edited out, or I might just include it in there just because that would be all of the lulls.
I wish I was clipping my nails, though. I definitely should do that.
That would be pretty funny. All right. So, wrapped up, we all see a Gopher victory. I think we all see it as probably tighter than it probably should be. I'm probably the more optimistic one because I am a total hater ass where I think that the Gophers really should dominate this team. If historical precedent is anything, I think a home opener against a team of or a road opener against a team of this caliber, without them having any film on us, we don't really have any film on them. We should just out-athlete them. If we execute, if we do all the cliche things, we execute, we don't turn the football over, we should beat this team by at least 2 touchdowns.
MB, I hear what you're saying, but I'll believe what you do.
I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to sit on my couch on Thursday night, probably suck down about 12 Surly Furiouses because I do it out of nervousness. I do this every time I watch a game, especially the season opener. So, yeah, I will probably be a hollowed out shell of a man on Friday, especially if we lose. Then I'm going to pull. Then I'm probably going to be about 2 on the Ben Sanderson scale. I don't know what it would take to get to 3 or level 4 Ben Sanderson.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm flying into Vegas on Wednesday afternoon. Going to sit there and play Pagao all Wednesday night and probably get pretty shit hammered, pushing the 3-4 on Ben Sanderson scale. Then probably get up a little later on Thursday, have a gigantic breakfast and consume 10,000 calories before noon. Then meeting up with some buds over at Mandalay Bay. We'll play some craps for a few hours. Then I will drink enough calories to put my breakfast to shame. If we lose this game, I will be a 5 or 6 on the Ben Sanderson scale of drinking myself to death.
If they lose this game, I don't even want to start thinking about it, I guess, because I already have thought about it too much. So
yeah.
I think if we lose to UNLV in the season opener, I think we are talking about we're talking about pulling a University of Chicago here. We're just going to nuke the football program. We're going to bulldoze TCF Bank Stadium and let the East Corridor folk, power brokers on the Board of Regents, just tear everything down and build it into a biomedical research facilities.
There it is.
I promise you that if we lose this game, I will still be drunk on next Sunday's podcast.
And with that said, it's game week. It's the best time of the year. This is my app. This is a holiday. I have a 4-day weekend because I'm taking Friday off.
4-day weekend.
We'll catch you all on the flip side when we are discussing either a massive Gopher victory and we are all happy, or we are trying to identify Frothy Gopher's body in the Las Vegas morgue.
The bats, Frothy, the bats.
See you later, folks.
Take care, guys.
Peace out.